We know that pledge breaks are your least favorite part of listening to NHPR. So we've been trying really hard to eliminate them this month. If we manage it, if you help us manage it, we can eliminate those pledge breaks this month. But we need your help now to make it happen. More of your favorite programs, fewer interruptions when you make a gift now at nhpr.org. This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The issue of food safety has been on the radar of Americans since Upton Sinclair's The Jungle exposed conditions in Chicago meat plants in the early 1900s. That book prompted the first major legislation on the issue, the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906. Following that landmark law, piecemeal changes came over the decades to address individual incidents, leading to a patchwork system of regulations by the end of the century. Issues with that system came to a head in the 2000s with a number of major outbreaks of foodborne illnesses. One high-profile case unfolded around a beloved product for many Americans, peanut butter. That example, along with several others, led President Obama in 2009 to declare that enough is enough.
At bare minimum, we should be able to count on our government keeping our kids safe when they eat peanut butter. That's what Sasha eats for lunch, probably three times a week. And, you know, I don't want to have to worry about whether she's going to get sick as a consequence of having her lunch.
Since then, major national legislation addressing these issues was passed, 2011's Food Safety Modernization Act. But while it's been 5 years now, the FDA's rulemaking is only now trickling down to the states, including New Hampshire. Today in The Exchange, a new recipe for food safety. We'll look at how this law will affect farmers in our state, as well as consumers who may get their produce from everywhere, from Mexico to Florida to the farm stand down the road. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour to talk about this. Sandra Eskin joins us from D.C. She's director of the Safe Food Project at the Pew Charitable Trusts. Sandra, thanks for taking time out. We appreciate it. Heather Bryant is in studio as well, field specialist with UNH Cooperative Extension. Heather's been coordinating efforts around the new food safety law in New Hampshire. And Heather, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us, Roger Noonan. He owns and runs Middle Branch Farm in New Boston. Roger is also president of the New England Farmers Union. And Roger, thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
Sandra, I want to start with you. Why is this law necessary?
We've had a number of high-profile foodborne illness outbreaks in this country in the last couple decades. In fact, the CDC estimates that one in six Americans every year gets a foodborne illness. For some people, it's a tummy ache, but unfortunately for others, it can be serious and in some cases can cause death. So there was a consensus that came around to the notion that more can be done to try to prevent these illnesses. They can be done all along the supply chain. And in 2008, legislation was introduced. This wasn't the first piece of legislation aimed at improving safety, but for a whole host of reasons, the stars aligned and it wound up getting enacted.
Now, give us that number again, please, Sandra. One in six. Go ahead.
One in six. Each year, one in six Americans is going to suffer a foodborne illness.
Well,
again,
yeah.
It's across the food supply. It's many different bacteria, you know, pathogens, bacteria that can really make you sick or worse.
Well, just a headline from this morning's paper, there was a lawsuit filed by the family of an Ohio woman who died after she ate a salad processed at a Dole plant. She got listeria from that, her relatives say, and they have filed a wrongful death suit against the company. So there it is in the news just today. So, Sandra, just real quickly, be clear, please. These rules concern produce. We are not talking about meat or milk with these new rules.
These rules affect produce and everything in the supermarket, processed foods, bread, pasta, cheese, everything except meat and poultry products. For historical but not logical reasons, USDA regulates meat and poultry safety, and FDA regulates everything else, both domestically produced and imported.
So are we talking about milk also with these new FDA regulations?
Yes, we are.
Okay, milk and cheese products. All right. And one last question for you before I bring in our New Hampshire guests. What are some of the main illnesses that we have seen around produce in recent years? Again, as you mentioned, this legislation came about after several really sad cases.
Sure. I'll identify two. In 2006, there was an outbreak of infections from E. coli 0157, which is a very lethal strain of a bacteria. It caused four deaths, hundreds of illnesses, and I think it was the first time that people realized that these type of illnesses can be caused by otherwise what we think of as healthful products like spinach and other produce. And then a number of years ago, I believe it was 2011, there was an outbreak of Listeria infections linked to cantaloupe. And in that case, 33 people died. Listeria
wow.
is particularly hazardous to vulnerable populations, the elderly, children, and pregnant women and fetuses. So these are just two examples. And I just want to underscore the fact that the overwhelming number of foodborne illnesses are sporadic, which means they aren't linked to a particular product. So the good news is we have technology out there, including whole genome sequencing, that is enabling epidemiologists to identify illnesses much earlier and take action. So, I mean, that's the good news. I mean, the bad news is we still have foodborne illness. The good news is we're having tools and other standards that are going into place now that will hopefully reduce those preventable illnesses.
You know, I have to say, Sandra, I remember covering E. coli and other food contamination cases, heartbreaking cases, back in the 90s, but they were always concerning meat products, you know, undercooked meat at the fast food place or whatever. I think for a lot of Americans, you know, they don't think about getting illnesses from produce. You know, we're used to hearing about don't eat undercooked chicken and wash after you cut up chicken on the cutting board and so forth. But produce has seemed kind of impeccable.
And I think that is very true. But then you look at the data, you see what's happened over the course of the last few decades. Many, many pathogens start with animals. They start like E. coli that starts in the gut of cattle, but once the cattle sheds the bacteria, you know, in their feces, it can get in the water, it can contaminate the ground, it can actually even be brought across a distance in the wind and land on plants. And I think what that tells us is, you know, foodborne illness is you know, caused by very smart bacteria that are constantly evolving. And the reality is, too, that produce has been linked to almost as many outbreaks or close to as many outbreaks as meat and poultry. We became aware of it first in meat and poultry, correct. 1993, there was an outbreak linked to undercooked hamburgers. I think that was a big wake-up call. But we've seen things progress. Even just last week, there was a major recall and some illnesses linked to flour. Who thought that flour could be, in fact, contaminated with foodborne illness? Excuse me, with foodborne bacteria, and cause illness? But
well, and I want to bring you into Roger Noonan and Heather Bryant. And first of all, Roger, just tell us what you grow at Middle Branch Farm in New Boston.
We grow certified organic produce, serve CSA, I believe you're a member of as well.
Or used to be. I'm
used
lapsed.
To be. Well, that's okay. We do wholesale. We do direct retail, serve a lot of local markets and some regional markets as well.
Well, and is this law necessary, Roger? What do you think? Sandra's outlined some pretty scary cases of produce contamination.
Well, I don't know that we need to revisit whether or not it's necessary. It is the law. So I think what I'm most concerned about is how are we going to implement this in a way that doesn't disadvantage small farmers? I think when you look at most of these large cases of foodborne illness that Sandra alluded to, these were from very large farms, very far away from New Hampshire. I haven't seen data that shows instances of contamination locally. Now, I understand that statistically that's probably happening out there, but we have to understand FSMA was supposed to have flexibility for small entities.
FSMA, and, again, is Food Safety Modernization Act.
Food Safety Modernization Act. Excuse me. I'll try not to speak
that's
in acronyms.
That's okay.
And in creating that regulatory flexibility, they created basically the exemption for $500,000 and less serving to a certain specific 275 miles from your farm or exclusively in state and to certain qualified users. And that sounds good on the surface. But the reality is Food Safety Modernization Act represents the minimum food safety standards. There are already existing structures out there, third-party audits that have a higher standard in some cases than the Food Safety Modernization Act. So I'm not sure that I would put a sign on our barn or our truck that said we are exempt from the minimum food safety standards.
Who wants to advertise that?
Exactly.
It doesn't sound good.
So the reality is that we'll likely all end up adopting at least some standard that will meet or exceed the Food Safety Modernization Act.
And is that going to be a hassle for you, a pain in the neck, expensive?
Well, it's certainly going to be expensive. It's going to run, you know, from the smallest farms, it'll run maybe $5,000 to $12,000 for the medium-sized farms, and that would be sales, you know, $250,000 to $500,000 in sales. And then above that, you'd be looking at in excess of perhaps $20,000. For the larger farms, they're probably already complying with something like U.S. Department of Agriculture's good agricultural practices. So the reason that I got particularly involved, the New England Farmers Union in particular, got really deeply involved in this issue was a statement that the FDA had in their preliminary regulatory impact statement that said the cost of complying with FSMA, Food Safety Modernization Act, for farms that are not currently involved in food safety third-party systems may make them either grow produce not covered under the rule or not farm. And that has a huge impact.
That's pretty dramatic.
It is a very dramatic statement. Mike Taylor, the former commissioner, always said, well, that's kind of a gratuitous statement. And I'd say, well, it was your statement, Mike. So it's certainly an alarm bell. And if you're in this business that I'm in and Heather's in and many of my friends are in, you're going to have to take notice of that. And so we've worked with multiple stakeholders. I've met with Sandy many times and appreciate the work they're doing there. But and I think we made a lot of progress through the initial rulemaking. We've had several modifications to the rule to make it less onerous for small and mid-scale producers. We had multiple extensions of the comment period. I've got to thank NHPR and your show for having multiple segments on this. Our New Hampshire delegation from Congresswoman Custer, Carol Shea Porter, Frank Ginto, they've been back and forth, Senators Shaheen and Ayotte as well as the rest of the New England delegation for making FDA come to New England after they dropped that first draft of the rule to see the diversity we have here. You know, we're not Southern California where it's 1,000 acres of spinach here and 1,000 acres of this here. It's very diverse. We have a lot of value-added production on farm, which brings a lot of our farms, including mine, into another category. We're also subject to preventive controls rule. Now, we may have modified or reduced requirements because of the size of these operations, but it does add another layer of regulatory burden.
So lots to pick up on here that you raise, Roger. And Heather, I do want to bring you into this as well. You've been working with New Hampshire farmers on compliance with this. What are you hearing?
Well, I think one thing that's really important to recognize is that Roger, because of his work with New England Farmers Union, has eaten, lived, slept, breathed this stuff for several years, and he knows it inside and out. But some farmers don't. And so, you know, if they try to open up the rules and read them for themselves, they're hundreds of pages long. And so they are looking to us to try and help explain it in plain language and help them figure out, okay, this is what the rule says. What do I need to do? How am I going to comply with this in a way that doesn't, you know, force me to downsize my business in order to make it work?
Or change it,
right.
For example. People love growing tomatoes. They don't want to stop growing tomatoes. And they've got a great customer base for those tomatoes. So if I were a small local farmer and I came to you and said, help, 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 I want to just keep doing what I'm doing. My customers love me. I love what I'm doing. what is this new law going to mean for me? What would be your sort of short answer to that question?
Well, first I would start with a lot of questions. Extension has a tendency to do that.
Sure.
Because there are several levels of compliance within the rule based on size, like Roger alluded to, based on size or based on the products that you're growing. So I'd try to figure out, you know, where are they?
Do you even fall under this thing?
Right, exactly. And then the next, you know, step that we're telling everybody to do, where, regardless of where they think they're going to fall in the rule, is to really take a look at their financial records and see if they can show what are their total food sales, what are their total produce sales, what are their total sales that are direct market, because the way the exemptions and the modified requirements work, if you can't prove you're eligible for them, you could lose them. So that's really the first thing that people need to do, is guess where they think they're going to fall in the rule and then look at their financial records to see if they can prove it.
What about Roger's concern? And Sandra, I want to ask you this too, but Heather, you first, please. Roger's concern that, okay, technically you're exempt, but this becomes a standard that customers expect, that the food co-op expects, that the local farmers market says, we only buy from farmers who meet XYZ standards. So even though on paper you're exempt and you can forget about it, the marketplace starts to have this expectation that you will meet these standards. And so there you are.
Yeah, and that is something that we're very concerned about. But I think the other thing to keep in mind is that farmers are very, very conscious of food safety.
Sure.
Roger said that, you know, nobody wants to be seen as doing the minimum, right? So, you know, farmers will make changes if they identify problems on their farm. So I think you will see even people who are not covered or have some sort of an exemption, you know, they're going to fix any problems that they find. This is raising a lot of awareness.
Sandra, I'm going to bring you in that question, too. Again, Roger's concern that, sure, on paper, I don't have to comply, but people will expect it.
I totally understand that and sympathize with it. I think one of the hopes is that, yes, there are multiple standards out there, some of which are very similar to what the law requires, but some of them aren't. And I think the hope is, over time, not too long a time period, that everyone will converge on the standards in FSMA required by the Food Safety Modernization Act, and we won't be dealing with multiple audits. Again, science-based requirements, in many instances, these private standards don't necessarily go to safety. But I don't want to minimize that problem, and I think the issue is, you know, how we work with the marketplace and how do we try to make sure that we're talking about science-based standards.
The Exchange phone number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at new rules that are starting to come to local farms and producers under the Food Safety Modernization Act, or FSMA, as a lot of people call it. And here's a Facebook comment that came in before the show from Daniel, and I'll throw this to you, I think, Roger. Daniel asks, how often are cases of foodborne illnesses the result of eating food bought from the local farmers market?
That's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that. There's probably a documented case or two out there, but I've never seen any hard data to support it.
And how, as we talk
Sandy
about...
Sandy would be the one to ask about
sure.
that.
Actually, okay, go ahead, Sandy. Yeah. Do we know?
Again, you know, when we're looking at foodborne illness, the reality is the overwhelming illnesses are sporadic cases, one person here, one person there, and those aren't picked up by the public health system necessarily. Outbreaks constitute maybe 5%. I do have instances where food, local food, however we characterize it, you know, has been linked to illnesses, and I'm, you know, happy to share it with people who are interested. But again, the fact that so many cases are not picked up by the public health surveillance system is one of the reasons why we don't hear about those cases. We hear about these major multi-state outbreaks.
All right. The Exchange number again is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Daniel, thank you for that Facebook comment. We'll take more of your questions and comments after a short break, and we'll get into some of the details as to what these rules really aim to do. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're digging into the Federal Food Safety Modernization Act, or FSMA, and what it means for farmers and consumers here in New Hampshire. We want you to call in 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. Again, 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. With us in studio, Roger Noonan. He owns and runs Middle Branch Farm in New Boston, which grows organic produce. Roger is also president of the New England Farmers Union. Heather Bryant is with us, field specialist with UNH Cooperative Extension. She's been coordinating efforts around the new food safety law in New Hampshire. And Sandra Eskin joins us from D.C. She's director of the Safe Food Project at the Pew Charitable Trusts. One more time, the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Well, all of you, we've talked broadly about, you know, whether these regulations were necessary or not, what we hope they will do. Sandra, to you first. So which ones specifically are going into place right now, and what are they going to require?
Well, first, let me make clear that the first time farmers, and it would be larger operations, are going to have to meet the rules. It's not for another 18 months.
Wow.
So I want to underscore that, and that's one of the ways I think FDA appreciated that for many, many farmers, this is a whole new world. Okay, so what do these produce rules do? They establish standards aimed at reducing possible contamination from sources that can, in fact, contaminate produce. We often talk about the four W's. So one is water. So agricultural water, water used in any part of the operation, can be contaminated. The water can contaminate the produce. Waste, really, we're talking about is manure, or what's called in the law, you know, biological amendments, basically raw manure, composted manure. Again, if not properly treated, if, you know, can be a source, or if necessary time isn't taken to have the bacteria die off, it can be a problem. So waste, water, workers. We need to ensure that the people who harvest and pack have adequate hand washing facilities and toilets, and wildlife. Wildlife can cross fields and they can leave deposits that can in fact contaminate the produce. There's one more that's added by FSMA, and that is tools and equipment. Whatever's used, again, in growing and packing, if the tool itself gets contaminated and it contacts the produce.
We could put that under workers, though, just to keep it under the 4W.
That would be great.
Well, and congratulations, by the way, for coming up with an easy way to explain something that is very complicated.
Yeah.
I was looking at this yesterday.
I will not take credit for the 4Ws. People who spent a lot of time on produce safety came up with it, but it's a pretty understandable way to explain what exactly we're trying to achieve here.
Well, and looking at those 4Ws, you know, Heather, I'm thinking, wow, I mean, that's a lot to keep track of. Just the first one, water, I mean, you use it to water your plants, you use it to wash the produce before you sell it. How does a farmer even begin to get his or her hands around judging whether water is safe or not?
That is probably going to be the most challenging part of implementing the produce safety rule for farms. There are basically the FDA has set up standards of how clean the water needs to be based on what you're doing with it and what crops you're using it on. And it sort of breaks down into four categories. So the farmer will really need to keep track of what are they doing, where's the water coming from. They'll need to test it. They'll need to keep records on that testing. There's some complicated math that they're going to need to do with the results of the testing. And the FDA is working on creating guidance documents and a computer program that will help farmers do that.
You've got to get your water tested now for a certain level of cleanliness, safety standards, and so forth. And by the way, we've done multiple shows recently on water contamination problems here in New Hampshire, contaminants like PFOA and so forth.
Yes.
Did you want to add in there?
So what the farms are being asked to test for is generic E. coli. The FDA is hoping that that will be a simple test. Of course, the challenge is, you know, the rules are supposed to be science-based. Is that really... There's a lot of concern out there that perhaps the standards are too strict, not strict enough.
Well, and testing for E. coli, correct me if I'm wrong, Roger, couldn't that change day by day based on, you know, whether a herd of deer happened to be near your water supply?
Yeah, the water testing is particularly, I think, challenging for farmers in New Hampshire because we do tend to use a lot of surface water. And we're measuring for generic E. coli, which I think we're still using the EPA recreational water standard. But they did provide, you know, given the back and forth the farm community has had with FDA, you know, we did get them to accede to, well, look, there can be a die-off. So if I spray my lettuce today with the water out of the Piscataquag River, there's, you know, in 3 days there would be a die-off of any potential pathogens. And that was, you know, a pretty large gain right there. But still, I'm still going to have to test that. I'm going to have to test it very frequently to establish the baseline.
Now, how frequently?
It will depend on the I'm not really sure.
Like every week, every month, every year?
It'll probably be monthly.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll have to take 5 samples each time. And that's probably going to run – right now it would cost me $35 per water sample. But I think once you get a large number of farms doing that, you probably get a volume discount. Maybe Nelson Analytics said they may be able to get it down to $15 per test. And, you know, and I do these – you know, I will take these test results and then I'll have them available for an inspector should and when an inspector ever have to show up, which is another question. But if you just allow me, I just want to back up. We talked about exempt from FSMA. But the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, which the Food Safety Modernization Act is an amendment to, does not exempt anybody from putting safe food to the public. So regardless, if I'm the smallest, you know, farmer that's just showing up at the farmer's market on a Saturday, I'm liable to, you know, legally bound, criminally liable to provide you with safe produce, uncontaminated food.
So to assure the public that might be listening saying, oh, small farms are exempt, maybe I don't want to buy food from that small farmer,
right.
You're saying no, absolutely not.
We already have a legal a law, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, that I mean, the Jensen brothers that grew this cantaloupe that Sandra talked about in the first segment, I mean, they're facing jail time if they're not already in jail for that outbreak.
Right, sure, but it's too late for the people who
It's too
died.
Late.
I mean,
it's too late, but that's a fairly serious penalty.
So regarding
And I also want you to understand too that in that case they had a third-party audit by Primus, which is one of the premier third-party food safety auditors with a 98% rating. So you know, we can have all the inspections we want, but it only takes one error, you know, to create that kind of problem.
So is it correct to say, what do you think, Roger, that while larger production facilities and farms and so forth have had problems, maybe they have more oversight than the small guys, but the small guys, because they're just smaller, there's just less chance along the way that there's going to be contamination. Is
well,
that a way to look at it?
I think I'd have to say maybe it's more about actuarial risk. If I'm shipping product, thousands and thousands of cases of product across the country, then my liability insurance, my product liability insurance would be a lot more expensive than it is. But since I'm not shipping that volume, my actuarial risk is relatively small. Now, FSMA is supposed to be a risk-based standard, and part of, at least in the, I don't know that it's spelled out in the rule, but some of the other FDA documentation says that produce farm inspections will be risk-based. And this would be a great question for Sandy. I don't know where the high-risk food registry is at that is supposed to help inform these inspections. But under the preventive controls rule, they did lay out an inspection regime based on, you know, the size of the facility.
So say that last part again, high risk.
High risk food registry, I believe, is what it was initially called. I'm not sure if they've changed the name.
And Sandra, does that mean sort of those food products that you especially have to watch out for? Is that what that is?
Yes, but it does not apply to produce. It applies to processed foods. And again, the law treats produce and processed foods differently. There is a minimum inspection frequency for facilities that produce processed foods. There is no minimum required inspection of farms. Can I comment on a couple of things that Roger said?
Sure. Go ahead, Sandra.
Yes, he is absolutely correct that the underlying law, the Food and Drug Law, says that if you, food producer, put into commerce food, you know, contaminated food that makes people sick, you're going to be responsible. But again, that's enforcement after the fact, as I think you noted, after people get sick. The importance of FSMA is before a single person gets sick, if an inspector, and in terms of produce, it will likely be someone from the Department of Health in New Hampshire because states are going to be having a big role to play. If they go on the farm and they test the water or any other aspect and see that a grower is not meeting the standard, they can be required to do so before a single item of produce is sold anywhere. So if the aim here is prevention, they'll have to take steps. The inspector will work with them. Extension agents like Heather, there's a lot of people out there who are going to be helping farmers comply. And I think that it's really important to understand the distinction with FSMA being prevention. That's number one. Number two, again, Roger is absolutely right. In that case with Jensen Farms and others, there were private third-party auditors, not inspectors, auditors, that many retailers and other other operations require growers to meet standards that they set, and the auditors, you know, audit against those standards. Those standards are not necessarily safety-based. They do not necessarily have the same features as the FSMA rules will. And I think that's an important distinction to make as well.
Let's hit the nail on the head, all of you. There is a concern, Sandra, I'm sure you're well aware of this, that the big guys will be able to comply, no problem. But there's this burgeoning local food movement here in New England. And I think the concern that we're hearing, Sandra, is that, you know, this is going to quash that really important, beloved movement, which its supporters say, by the way, is safer than these, you know, mega farms. So can you just address that broader concern?
Sure. And that was a concern from the very beginning when groups like Pew were working on getting the law passed. And that's why there are a number of exemptions, both based on size and based on what you actually grow. If you're growing, for example, produce that's going to be processed, frozen, canned, whatever, you're going to be exempt from the produce standards. That said, I think I know we are very mindful of these concerns and want to do everything that we can to lighten whatever burdens. I'm not going to, you know, ignore that these will cost money. So I think we and other groups have worked really hard to get FDA resources to put the rules in place, but most significantly resources to hire technical assistance to help growers meet the standards. And then again, states are going to be, you know, involved in ensuring compliance, make sure they're ready. And then also there is money for helping growers at every level have resources to meet the law. Rogers Group has applied for some of that funding. Other groups, like the National Sustainable Ag Coalition, and I know we've been supportive of that. And so at this point, the focus is what can we give growers in terms of resources and assistance? The extension programs are going to have a big role here to help them meet the requirements.
Well, and on that line, actually, of how states will make this happen, whether they'll have the resources to do it properly and help farmers out, joining us now on the line is Alexis Simpson. She's a Democratic representative from Exeter and a board member of NOFA-NH. That's the Organic Farmers Organization. And Alexis Simpson sits on the House Environment and Agriculture Committee. She's been involved in this issue. Representative Simpson, thank you very much for taking time out. We appreciate it.
Hi, thank you, Laura, for having me. It's good to be on.
Well, the House Agriculture Committee met in May, not that long ago, on this Food Safety Modernization Act, this FSMA that we've been talking about. What was discussed there?
Sure. In April, actually, the Environment and Agriculture Committee heard an update from the UNH Cooperative Extension and from the Food Protection Section of the Department of Health and Human Services to let us know how they were looking ahead towards the education and the implementation of the rule. For those of us on the Environment and Agriculture Committee especially, this is a big constituent issue. it's important for us to be able to communicate, especially to our farmers around the state, what the rollout of this implementation is going to look like. And then also for us, as we've been talking about here, to assure consumers that our food supply can be safe without skyrocketing prices of our local produce.
So those are the concerns, Representative Simpson, how to make the food safe but not have skyrocketing costs for local food.
Right, or to bankrupt our farmers or have them go out of business in an economy that where their profit margins are already slim.
Sure. Well, and Sandra Eskin just raised the concern that, you know, she likes this law, says here it is, but there is a broad concern among everybody that states won't have the resources that it takes to make sure this gets rolled out in the appropriate way. As far as you've been able to gather, Representative Simpson, what is going to be the role of state government in implementing this?
Yes, the cost, of course, is a concern for us, too. In early June, the Department of Health and Human Services applied for a grant from the FDA because the FDA really has asked the states to shoulder a big portion of implementing this rule. So we're not sure what that's going to look like. But the grant itself, which is about $300,000 a year for 5 years, that this particular grant that DHHS applied for is actually going to help them look at what the feasibility of the state being involved in inspection would be, but also gives money for education and technical assistance and any infrastructure, and then also to inventory the farms as well.
To inventory them. What does that mean exactly, Representative Simpson?
Well, you know, the FDA does not inspect farms now. So they don't actually have a list of who they'd be inspecting. And there's some language, I know, Roger, probably all of you know this better, but there's some language in the rule that you can't really require farms to register, I believe. So there's going to be a bit of a delicate balance here where the food protection section is really going to have to have the community's involvement and the farmers' involvement in trying to figure out who they need to inspect.
So hang on. So the state is supposed to inspect local farms, but there's no list of the local farms?
Well, right now the state's not going to inspect. Right now we just are applying for the grant to see if it's even feasible for us to have the state inspect. There's another grant that we could apply, and that's really where the conversation is now, is in a year or two, should DHHS apply for the grant to carry out inspections as a state rather than having the FDA do it?
So, right, does it happen at the state level? Does the FDA do it?
Right.
From what I've read, the FDA doesn't have the resources to do that, at least right now.
Right.
Anything else, Representative Simpson, that you think we need to know about this right now? It sounds like there's a lot of unknowns.
Yes, there are definitely a lot of unknowns. I think the thing, we've talked a little bit about this, but I talked to a farmer the other day who's already developing her food safety plan to be in compliance. From what people know, you know, Heather's talked about this, from what we know of the rule so far. And that was exciting to me because she was, you know, including photo documentation to show how she's carrying out her processes. But it was also notable to me that her farm is not big enough to require either or early or comprehensive preparation.
Yeah, that's something that, yeah, and I have to jump in on you, Representative Simpson. Yeah.
Let me just say quickly.
I want to let you finish that thought after, Representative Simpson, I'll let you finish that after a break. Okay, so hold on one second and we'll be back in a minute. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're digging into the Federal Food Safety Modernization Act, or FSMA, as it's called, and what it might mean for New Hampshire farmers and consumers. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. The act is aimed at reducing foodborne illnesses like E. coli and listeria. Have you had a foodborne illness? Where do you think it came from? Do you buy your produce at the grocery store or at the farm stand? And which do you perceive as safer? Again, let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Org. And just before the break, we were finishing up a call with Representative Alexis Simpson. She's a Democrat from Exeter and on the House Environment and Agriculture Committee. And go ahead, Representative Simpson, I'm sorry I had to interrupt you there. You were telling me about one farmer. It's okay. You were telling me about one farmer who, even though she was small enough to be exempt from these new rules, was going ahead anyway. Was that what you were saying?
Right. Because of the issue of she aggregates produce with a bigger farm that will have to comply in the early phase of the implementation. So she feels since they're aggregating produce together, she's really going to need to have the same food safety compliance as the bigger farm.
They
also go across state lines. They're a co-op that sells food across state lines, which I think makes them automatically needing to fulfill more of the compliance sooner.
So let me just make sure I got this right. So she's aggregating. Now, for outsiders, like, what does that really mean? You know, if she makes salsa, she gets everything but the onions from her own farm, but she has to get those from somewhere else?
Or
what does that mean
exactly? More of a farmer co-op where several farms come together and maybe they each grow different crops, but they bring them all together. Or they each grow the same crop, but they can sell it more easily if they all sell it together and they
under
can get
one
a better
umbrella.
Price for it.
Sure.
Exactly. So then you have smaller farms working with larger farms that will need to be compliant.
I see. So she has to be compliant because she's working with those bigger people.
Right.
I see. So what is she saying? Is she saying it's a pain in the neck? She can't do it. It's too expensive. Or is she saying, okay, this is just what I have to do?
She's saying she's working really hard. This is what I've got to do. And I'm working really hard to do it. And I found some resources and help. And we're going to do it together.
All right. Well, Representative Simpson,
It's really, to me, emblematic of how everyone in the state has worked so hard to figure out how we're going to make this rule work for New Hampshire.
You know, some people will call these rules, as they finally roll out, Representative Simpson, yet another example of government overreach. What do you think?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. I think that they've been a challenge, for sure. And I think it's a big challenge when you have a rule that's this large and affects this many people without perhaps, and we can't tell, but without perhaps the necessary funding to carry out the intentions of the rule. That's a big challenge for all of us. I think that's why, to me, it's looking forward, it's so important that nonprofits, the government, UNH, Cooperative Extension, that everybody's really coming together to make this happen.
Well, Representative Simpson, it's been good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's Alexis Simpson, again, a Democratic state rep from Exeter and on the House Environment and Agriculture Committee. One more time, that exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Roger, I have to ask you that same question. Government overreach here or necessary safety upgrade for our food system?
Well, I think I'm going to take the representative's position. And yeah, that's a tough question. As I said earlier, Laura, this rule, it's law. I'm not ready to sort of relitigate that. We have to ensure that we can implement this in a sane, responsible manner that doesn't jeopardize public health or put these farms out of business. Because these farms in New Hampshire there's so many multifunctional benefits to our New Hampshire farms, you know, wildlife, water, recreational use. It was one of the first things I raised with FDA was when they did not do an environmental impact statement to study the impact of the rules. And they ultimately did one because there's a lot of things that can drive farms to do certain things, fencing wildlife out of their fields, mowing back habitat around the perimeter of the field, which we actually encourage sort of buffer strips for pollinator habitat, which are also full of wildlife. Water. If I can't use surface water, pond water, river water, do I drill a well? Well, I'm in a suburban area. New Boston, New Hampshire is a suburbanizing area. Do I start tapping into the aquifer and depleting water? Resources for my neighbors. Those are all things. And then what happens if the farms are sold off and then they become, what's the impact of having more housing? Those things. What
so
does
if
it
these
do to
cost too much and you have to shut down your farm, it gets sold for,
right.
You know, a parking lot.
Right. Well, and, that,
and what's the environmental impact
that's
of that?
That's a potential outcome of losing farms. And we're losing farms at a very disturbing rate in New Hampshire already. So, I just want to, as a representative of a farm group, I have to say that we do in American agriculture deliver the safest food in the world already. So that these rules will assure that. And look, there's a lot of farms. We can all tune up our practices on farms. There may be some benefit. I mean, there a benefit to the farm itself and increased record keeping and things like that. But again, it comes with a cost to the farm. When you're talking about adding $15,000 annual compliance costs to a business that's doing grocery,
that's a lot.
That's a lot. And when you look at what we have, I think we have $25 to $30 million specialty crops. That's fruits and vegetables in New Hampshire. And the cost of implementing FSMA in New Hampshire becomes very, very high.
Is that your estimate, Roger?
That's from the USDA's National Agriculture Statistics Service.
$15,000 for...
Well, that estimate is an FDA estimate. Yeah. It's $12,000 to $15,000.
For compliance. That's a lot, though, annual. For a small farmer. You guys don't have $12,000 of extra cash rattling around in your pockets.
Very seldom. And that doesn't include the capital costs to, say, bring your packing shed up to the standard with the stainless steel tables. And ultimately, we really don't know what an FDA produce farm inspection is going to look like under FSMA. I mean, I have here a guide to produce farm investigations, and this is a very onerous inspection. Now, these inspections would be you've had some problem and they've come out to look. So they're looking, it's a very targeted inspection. But without guidance from FDA on what does this produce farm inspection look like, what will the inspector come out to my farm be looking for?
If there is even an inspector. I mean, we've talked about nobody has the money. Is the state going to do it? Are the feds going
to
do it?
Well, right now the effort is to get the states to do it, and that there's going to be multiple approaches depending upon each state's agency of authority. I know in Vermont, which is, I think, a little bit ahead of the curve in New England on this, you know, they're already talking about state FSMA certificates for all producers. Well, what is a FSMA certificate? FDA does not have the authority to accredit anybody as being compliant with FSMA. And as an organic farmer, I'll tell you, before we had certified organic, you had multiple entities and you had a whole lot of confusion in the marketplace. So my concern as a producer is, will my product not be able to go to Vermont because I don't have Vermont certificate, or not go to Massachusetts, or do I ultimately have to have five or six different audits or inspections or comply with some other state-mandated thing? So we look to USDA GAP as something that's nationally accepted, globally accepted, as the best vehicle.
I want to let you jump into here, Heather. Concerns about the costs, concerns that there'll be too much, concerns about whether this is even going to happen.
Yeah, and I think another concern is, you know, are they science-based? And then also, you know, what is the impact on the consumer? I think it's important to remember that while food safety is critically important, so is a healthy diet. And, you know, we all know the risks associated with diabetes and heart disease, and a good way to try and prevent those things is to eat your fruits and vegetables.
Well, so. We started out talking about that, didn't we, that it's so frustrating because we're getting that message all the time, five a day, fruits and veggies, and so forth. So are you saying, Heather, kind of put this in perspective?
I do think that as consumers, as people, we do need to balance risks. We all know that car accidents can take lives, but here in New Hampshire, it'd be pretty challenging to live without a car. And so we take the safety precautions we can take, and we live with the risk beyond that. And so I think, you know, with food safety and with the Food Safety Modernization Act in particular, that's what we're trying to do. You take what steps you can to try and prevent it, and then you recognize that there's no zero-risk scenario.
I have a really simple, simple question for you, Heather. Does extra scrupulous washing of produce help get rid of E. coli, Listeria, anything like that? Or
it can help significantly. One thing to keep in mind, though, is that there are some microorganisms that can get inside of the fruits and vegetables.
Mm-hmm. and inside the fiber and the meat of
yes.
the
Yes, and
the
so once that happens, then no amount of washing is going to fix it. So, yes, scrupulous washing is a good first step, but you know, it's not the only it's not a perfect solution.
Yeah, and some things you don't want to overwash, like basil, Roger, you know.
Right.
You don't want to overwash your basil. It gets limp and beat up, and it doesn't taste good, and it doesn't do what you need it to do. So
we try to limit washing of produce on our farm as much as possible because that's a vector for pathogens.
Well, let's take a call, and Gardner joins us from Amherst. Hi, Gardner. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm very curious about this. I had heard a little about it a while ago, and to hear you discussing this today really brings home some of my thoughts on this. I was just wondering if anyone there might be able to comment on the constitutionality of this. One of the things that I think is interesting is whether or not having this much knowledge about the details of the FDA regulations, anybody might be able to tell me what actual clause of the Constitution would give the federal government this power. And specifically speaking, oftentimes people try to use an open-ended interpretation of the Interstate Commerce Clause, and this would very clearly seem to not apply to interstate commerce. This seems to be intrastate commerce, and regardless of the Supreme Court precedents on it, which I think would go in favor of removing these regulations, I would just wonder if anybody could cite for me the passage of the Constitution outside of any notation of the Interstate Commerce Clause that gives the federal government this power to do this.
Okay, to regulate food safety. And Sandra, I don't know if you can answer that in a general way, the power of the federal government to regulate this area.
The caller actually answered the question. It is the Interstate Commerce Clause, and in areas of health and safety, it is broadly interpreted and to include both commerce between states and commerce within states. I'm happy to offline provide the caller with some background information, but it is the Interstate Commerce Clause that is the constitutional foundation for food safety regulation.
Well, and speaking of interstate commerce, you know, we're talking about produce from Vermont or Florida or New Hampshire or wherever. But from what I understand, Sandra, a lot of people, probably myself included, in the wintertime, get our produce from far away, from Chile, from Mexico, from Israel, from Spain. What does this law say about safety from imported food? We've certainly heard about problems with that as well.
Absolutely, and it does address import safety. What it does, for the first time, it establishes the responsibility being the importers to ensure that the food that's being imported meets a comparable level of safety as domestic. So there is going to be a documentation that the importer needs to provide that verifies that fact. There are a lot of components to how FSMA regulates imports, but that's the foundational one. So that's very important, but like the produce rule, there are lots of details that need to be worked out, even though we have final rules, there need to be guidances and structures. But again, the goal is to establish a level playing field between domestic and foreign farms and manufacturing facilities.
So that's a concern that U.S. agriculture producers have, Sandra, that, you know, importers won't be held to as high a standard. And this is an effort to make sure that that happens?
Yes.
How is that going to happen? We talked about, you know, even here in this little state of New Hampshire, nobody really knows who's going to do the inspections. Is it the state? Is it the feds? Is there enough money? Seems like from what I've read right now, there isn't enough money to make this happen. So I'm wondering how the import inspections are even going to happen.
Well, inspection is a very small piece of the overall compliance strategy. There is a foreign facility inspection requirement. Again, I want to underscore facility, not farm. And it's ultimately supposed to be upwards of 20,000 facilities, but given financial constraints, I think FDA has only done about 2,000 a year. So that is concerning, but groups like Pew have spent a lot of time and energy and resources trying to get FDA more money, and we've succeeded to a very large degree since the law was enacted. I think we've added about close to $300 million of additional funding for FDA to bring this law, you know, online. And as we mentioned earlier, at least last year, money from fiscal year 2016, we have about $20 million that's going to go to the states. We talked about a little bit earlier where New Hampshire is going to get $300,000. But back to your point on imports, it is going to take resources and coordination. FDA is working with other countries to determine whether their systems are comparable. Again, this whole foreign supplier verification program, how do you verify it? But you have to use audits. There are a lot of pieces that still have to come together. I think that, of course, passing the law is often the easy part. It's
right.
The implementation and the funding that really takes some time and patience. But the import issue is a significant one, especially because imports have increased. Food imports significantly over the last number of years.
Sure. Well, and I just wonder, Sandra, if there's anything else that you want people to know about this before we go. We've got about a minute left. Just people like me who eat a ton of fresh produce, what do you want us to know about this?
I agree with Roger and many others that we have one of the safest food supplies in the world, and it's produced by small entities, medium-sized entities, bigger. But of course, the issue is, can we make it safer? When we began working to push for implementation of this new food safety law, we did a lot of consumer polling. And overwhelmingly, 90% of consumers supported the very type of requirements, produce safety standards, inspections of facilities that FSMA entails. So consumers should continue to eat a healthy, varied diet, listen to news reports that there are recalls. Don't eat recalled products, but work to ensure through your pocketbook that you want to support all types of, certainly, farms and facilities in their states. The goal here is not to put anybody out of business. The goal here is to help everybody raise the bar on safety.
Well, and I'm sure our local farmers here in studio would say, hooray for that. So I will close out on that note. Sandra, thank you for being here. Heather and Roger, thank you as well. This is The Exchange on NHPR.